Chapter 2, How It Often Happens That a Discourse Which Gives Pleasure to the Hearer is Distasteful to the Speaker, and What Explanation is to be Offered of that Fact. 3. But as regards the idea thus privately entertained by yourself in such efforts, I would not have you to be disturbed by the consideration that you have often appeared to yourself to be delivering a poor and wearisome discourse. For it may very well be the case that the matter has not so presented itself to the person whom you were trying to instruct, but that what you were uttering seemed to you to be unworthy of the ears of others, simply because it was your own earnest desire that there should be something better to listen to. Indeed, with me, too, it is almost always the fact that my speech displeases myself, for I am covetous of something better, the possession of which I frequently enjoy within me before I commence to body it forth in intelligible words. And then when my capacities of expression prove inferior to my inner apprehensions, I grieve over the inability which my tongue has betrayed in answering to my heart. For it is my wish that he who hears me should have the same complete understanding of the subject which I have myself, and I perceive that I fail to speak in a manner calculated to effect that, and that this arises mainly from the circumstance that the intellectual apprehension diffuses itself through the mind with something like a rapid flash, whereas the utterance is slow and occupies time and is of a vastly different nature, so that while this latter is moving on, the intellectual apprehension has already withdrawn itself within its secret abodes. Yet in consequence of its having stamped certain impressions of itself in a marvelous manner upon the memory, these prints endure with the brief pauses of the syllables, and as the outcome of these same impressions, we form intelligible signs which get the name of a certain language, either the Latin, or the Greek, or the Hebrew, or some other. And these signs may be objects of thought, or they may also be actually uttered by the voice. On the other hand, however, the impressions themselves are neither Latin, nor Greek, nor Hebrew, nor peculiar to any other race whatsoever, but are made good in the mind, just as looks are in the body. For anger is designated by one word in Latin, by another in Greek, and by different terms in other languages according to their several diversities. But the look of the angry man is neither peculiarly Latin nor peculiarly Greek. Thus it is that when a person says erratus sum, he is not understood by every nation, but only by the Latins. Whereas if the mood of his mind when it is kindling to wrath comes forth upon the face and affects the look, all who have the individual within their view understand that he is angry. But again, it is not in our power to bring out those impressions which the intellectual apprehension stamps upon the memory, and to hold them forth, as it were, to the perception of the hearers by means of the sound of the voice, in any manner parallel to the clear and evident form in which the look appears. For those former are within in the mind, while this latter is without in the body. Wherefore we have to surmise how far the sound of our mouth must be from representing that stroke of the intelligence, seeing that it does not correspond even with the impression produced upon the memory. Now, it is a common occurrence with us that, in the ardent desire to effect what is of profit to our hearer, our aim is to express ourselves to him exactly as our intellectual apprehension is at the time, when, in the very effort, we are failing in the ability to speak. And then, because this does not succeed with us, we are vexed, and we pine in weariness as if we were applying ourselves to vain labors. And, as the result of this very weariness, our discourse becomes itself more languid and pointless, even than it was when it first induced such a sense of tediousness. 4. But oft-times the earnestness of those who are desirous of hearing me shows me that my utterance is not so frigid as it seems to myself to be. From the delight, too, which they exhibit, I gather that they derive some profit from it, and I occupy myself sedulously with the endeavor not to fail in putting before them a service in which I perceive them to take in such good part what is put before them. Even so, on your side also, the very fact that persons who require to be instructed in the faith are brought so frequently to you ought to help you to understand that your discourse is not displeasing to others as it is displeasing to yourself. And you ought not to consider yourself unfruitful simply because you do not succeed in setting forth in such a manner as you desire the things which you discern, for perchance you may be just as little able to discern them in the way you wish. For in this life who sees except as in an enigma and through a glass? Neither is love itself of might sufficient to rend the darkness of the flesh and penetrate into that eternal calm from which even things which pass away derive the light in which they shine. But inasmuch as day by day the good are making advances towards the vision of that day, independent of the rolling sky, and without the invasion of the night, which eye has not seen nor ear heard, neither has it entered into the heart of man. There is no greater reason why our discourse should become valueless in our own estimate, when we are engaged in teaching the uninstructed, than this, namely that it is a delight to us to discern in an extraordinary fashion, and a weariness to speak in an ordinary, and in reality we are listened to with much greater satisfaction, indeed when we ourselves also have pleasure in the same work, for the thread of our address is affected by the very joy of which we ourselves are sensible, and it proceeds from us with greater ease and with more acceptance. Consequently, as regards those matters which are recommended as articles of belief, the task is not a difficult one to lay down injunctions, with respect to the points at which the narration should be commenced and ended, or with respect to the method in which the narration is to be varied, so that at one time it may be briefer, at another more lengthened, and yet at all times full and perfect. And again, with respect to the particular occasions on which it may be right to use the shorter form, and those on which it will be proper to employ the longer. But as to the means by which all is to be done, so that everyone may have pleasure in his work when he catechizes, for the better he succeeds in this, the more attractive will he be. That is what requires the greatest consideration, and yet we have not far to seek for the precept which will rule in this sphere. For if, in the matter of carnal means, God loves a cheerful giver, how much more so in that of the spiritual? But our security that this cheerfulness may be with us at the seasonable hour is something dependent upon the mercy of him who has given us such precepts. Therefore, in accordance with my understanding of what your own wish is, we shall discuss in the first place the subject of the method of narration, then that of the duty of delivering injunction and exhortation, and afterwards that of the attainment of the said cheerfulness, so far as God may furnish us with the ideas.